Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
So, welcome to our discussion about security and developer experience. And are these opposites or the same? We're going to be informal here. We're going to be chatty, conversational. If you have questions, please do. We're not going to be using the app, so just raise your hands and we can have a conversation among us. Just to sort of kick off with a few introductions. When we were preparing for this, the three of us were sort of sat staring at each other going, Why are we here? What do I know about this topic? And I think we're all bringing something quite different, which is good. It's the diversity that we heard about in the morning keynote. So I can start with myself, because when we were preparing, Abby looked at me and Adrian and said, "And you two are the security experts." And I felt this real moment of horror, because I know about as much about security as I do about statistics and concurrency, which is nothing. I try and avoid the topic. So I'm here to represent the developer experience aspect. I know a lot about developer experience. I care a lot about developer experience. I think it's important. And as we will discuss, it is not always entirely compatible with security, especially when done wrong. So we will try and fix that. So Abby, why are you here? What do you know about security?
Why am I here? So I think the angle I'm involved in is the platform engineering side. So how do we actually deliver developer experience from the requirements of the business through to the engineers who are going to need to actually build the software within those constraints and those requirements? So my background is internal tooling, internal support teams, and currently working on a product that helps people build those internal supports.
So Adrian, do you know anything about security? Otherwise, this could be a very short discussion.
Well, I mean, actually, the first time I was at GoTo must be 10 years ago now. And what had happened is I wrote a book on Docker. But don't buy it because it's very old and out of date. But I wrote a book on Docker, and there's a security chapter in it that I felt I had to write. And that turned out to be one of the most popular chapters. But I always felt like I wasn't a security person, and I was always scared, because I never wanted to say something wrong that got somebody hacked, you know, or somebody come and say, "No, you can't tell people that." I was very much scared to move into the security area, I guess. And I still am a little bit. But yeah, that took off. I was asked to do talks on Docker security, so I kind of ended up there. And now I do a lot of talks about supply chain security, and I joined a security company. So hopefully I know a little bit about security. If not, yeah.
I mean, that's such an interesting point about the fear, though, because a lot of coding disciplines, I think, are about the enjoyment of our craft and the creation of value and hopefully, you know, delight for users, whereas security is all about the fear and the horror. And in the previous panel, one of the things that Sarah was talking about was that if you do sustainability, there's an expectation that you have to be purer than pure. And if you talk about sustainability, then you can't take a flight, because then you know you're a hypocrite. And I think it must be the same with security as well. That, like, if you talk about developer experience and you get three quarters of the way there, people are like, "Oh yeah, nice try." If you talk about security and you get three quarters of the way there, people are like, "Well, where's my bank account?"
But I mean, the thing is, if you have perfect security, which isn't possible, but if you did have perfect security, what would happen? Nothing. Right, that's what security is. Nothing bad happening.
Yeah.
So it's very hard to tell how good your security is, because it means nothing's happening, and that's probably why we care a little bit less about it. But then what happens is you have big incidents, like the incidents with NPM that we're seeing at the minute, and suddenly people do care. And you know, things like SolarWinds and Log4j. At those times, people had very bad days or weeks or months, and people really care. And people really care at the minute at Jaguar Land Rover, who just got a £2 billion pound bailout because of, you know, they got a, I don't know how many people know, but Jaguar Land Rover, there was a big breach. I think it was ransomware, maybe. And yeah, the supply chains, as in the physical supply chain, is so backed up. And other companies are dependent, so the government had to bail them out to the tune of $2 billion, which I find astonishing.
Yeah, so I think you're right that security is definitely the worst subject in the world, because in the optimum case, when you do it perfectly, nobody notices and nobody cares and nobody says good job, and yeah. Every other case is worse than that.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like the oxygen in the room, right? Like you need it to live, but nobody really wants to have to think about it much or do much with it.
Yeah. So just to sort of, for a pulse of the room, who among you would say you're sort of security professionals or security? Okay, I just did the fear, right? who among you had been considering it but have just got so depressed by what I've said that you're now like leaving the field? So for the rest of you, what's your sort of involvement in security? Is it something that you've come because you want to know more about it, or because you want to know how to negotiate with your security team, or
Thank you. So as an engineering manager, I want engineers to be productive, right? And sometimes security says no. So I think I've been in a lot of conversations where I had to convince people that software engineers have different needs than, you know, people that only live in Microsoft Office, and that we do care about security. It's just that we built the things that also need to be secure. So if you make our thing too secure in like your world, then you might prevent us from even building our things. And this friction exists quite often, especially in large organizations that are not IT first. So that's why I'm here.
I think like the access to tools and sort of like needing a green list to get access to different websites and things like that all the time. Yes.
Yeah, you're so right, actually. I forgot that in my summary, my depressing summary, which I should have mentioned, which is that in the optimum case with security, nobody notices. In the typical optimum case, everybody hates you while you're preventing the problems. And
I think if we're talking about the developer experience side of and competition with security in this, we were talking a bit before about how you end up with a shadow IT. I think more so than in almost any other discipline within software engineering stuff is people are trying to get around the security requirements. I may or may not have pictures of people's screens, including like proprietary code that is sent to me through non-secure avenues from random jobs I've been at, because they couldn't log in, they couldn't send a screenshot via email to me because it needed to be through secure channels, or they couldn't, we couldn't share in a Slack channel because one of our orgs was Slack, the other one was Microsoft Teams, or whatever it is. And so you actually wind up with more insecurity when you lock down to a point where people can't do their jobs, to your point. So I think that's the biggest risk.
Yeah, I just want to talk to the point. All of you actually mentioned that how do you become the security expert, and how do you actually then do it? It seems like it's something we may be doing on the side next to the actual code development, product development. And that makes me wonder, is it just because software engineering is a very young engineering discipline? Because in other I know it's an old analogy, construction, building engineering, civil engineering, and so on. There are codes you have to do, you have to follow certain ways of building. You can't use poor concrete. People also have professional insurances, and people who have a history of building unsafe systems, they lose that insurance and get weeded out pretty quickly. Why don't we have that in software engineering yet? There's also been this idea of product liability in software engineering being kicked around for some years now. You're probably familiar with it, but we can all just write, well, this is a software product, so there's no warranty no matter how you use this.
Yeah.
Whereas if you buy a blender, a food processor, and it doesn't work for the purpose, you're liable as a company.
I think there probably are liabilities regardless of what you put in our things. I would also say there are, you can buy cybercrime insurance, and companies do buy that. I'm not sure how effective it is and in which instances you can claim, but
it's not the manufacturer that buys them, it's the customer.
Right. Well, I mean, I was thinking more like, you know, Jaguar Land Rover, and like they may well have a cybercrime, you know, to protect against ransomware and stuff. So you do get examples of that. But so engineering practice. So, I mean, I think you've, yeah, people have said this a long time, like, why aren't we accredited? And, you know, anybody can go and write software and put it out there, which I'm not against. I don't think like, that's a bad thing. But, you know, there is risk there. And everybody uses open source, and anybody can put open source out there. I don't know that I really have a solution. What I would go back to is, when you mention security there, so often it's an afterthought, right? We build the application and then we think about security. I think that's really the problem that I'd like to see addressed first. Let's try and think about security closer to the start and build it in then when it's going to be done properly and you don't have to retrofit things.
I think that's a really good point. So a lot of, I think, why we don't have the professional like licenses and things is because we can't agree on what quality means.
Yeah. Mm.
So I was my title was QA for 6 or 7 years while I was at ThoughtWorks, and the number of conferences I've gone to where like every talk is like, how do you define quality? What does good look like? And all that. So how would we define what a professional looks like? Like, I don't think we have that today in software. But one thing I thought about while you were sharing, I wish we could talk about security earlier, which I think is important, is that what is security? I think when we think about security, we think a lot about, can you get hacked? Can, you know, what is a secure supply chain? What is, you know, open ports, you know, access? But so much of it is just assuming that any malintent could occur. And people don't like code defensively enough against that. Like, how many times have we written, you know, an API endpoint that doesn't validate data before sending it off to the database or before doing some sort of actions with it? And I think that defensive coding and that assumption that you don't know what your users are going to do is maybe the first line of what, as a software engineer, what we need to be worrying about from security. And yes, there's all the scanning and all those other things we need to do, but that's where experts can come in. And I think talking about developer experience with security, I think we really fell over a bit. As much as I love DevOps as a set of principles, we fell over a bit with this idea that each team has to do it themselves. And that's where you end up in that position of, I feel like I'm doing it as like a secondary job because I'm by myself on my team having to go end to end with all the specialties and figuring it out as I go, when in reality, we need to empower the smaller number of experts to have that outsourced or outsized impact at their organization, bring that security to the teams. And so I think that's where the platform engineering and developer experience side is coming in today to say, we had a huge improvement from dev and ops being kind of mortal enemies to DevOps being like, we can deliver a fast flow of value independent as a team, not having central constraints. But we're now paying a huge cost duplication across our teams. How do we centralize without slowing our teams down? How do we create contracts that allow for our teams to be independently delivering value, but not needing to own that whole stack? And I think that's the promise of platform engineering and developer experience today. And I think we're still trying to figure out how to actually deliver on that promise, just being honest, but that's where I'm hoping we go. So.
Yeah, and I guess that sort of comes back to that fear aspect that, you know, if you get told you're the security expert for our team, that's scary, and you do need that expertise. Yeah, Rasmus.
So I think it all comes down to an organizational problem, as everything does. To me, platform engineering is a desert idea. It's an idea where you have a centralized thing, you want more control, and building stuff so other people can be creative in a very tiny space. Whereas I think we need to... it's difficult, but we need to change the organization to support this. You can't just tell people to be security experts, okay, but we need to find a way to embed security knowledge into teams so that we can discuss these things and say, well, how can we make our product more secure instead of asking security, how should that work, or wait for security to deduct it on us?
Do you not feel platform engineering plays a role by like having like secure defaults?
Well, I think it's what platform engineering is trying to do is with the centralization is it's trying to say, when I say to the team, you should have security built in, you should be thinking about it, to what level? We talk full stack engineer. Okay, are you plugging in your power cables? Like, what is full stack? Is it down to the metal? Is it down to the networking? Is it down to the cloud provider level? Is it down to just the container level? Is it just the application code? Full stack is something that, you know, is almost laughable because it's like, well, what is it? And what platform engineering is trying to do is create contracts that say, my stack is shorter. Therefore, I can be more informed and more effective within that stack. And so to your point, I think, yes, what platform engineering is trying to do is it's trying to push down the requirements, the security requirements that can be generalized across teams. Not all of them can be. So things like scanning for dependency, you know, CVEs and things are something that should an app dev really have to be thinking about how to do that, or should they just be getting the feedback on it? But at the same time, thinking about, you know, what data cleaning looks like needs to be within the domain of the software engineering team, because they're the ones that know who's using the application, what the data is, what the context is there. So that's where I think the centralization is, where people see risk in platform engineering. So by centralizing, are we going back to those days of feeling like we have to wait on the central team to do the thing? But done right, the nuance of the difference of where platform engineering is going is it's centralizing access to stuff. It's not centralizing control of, like, full out. So.
Yeah,
shortening the stack.
Yeah, I think there's sort of there's because I get your discomfort, because there's definitely platform engineering anti-patterns that you do see. So you see the sort of the platform engineering as the enforcer rather than the enabler, which is obviously doing it wrong. And then I think as well, I've certainly seen platform engineering where this sort of leaky abstraction gets imposed on the team, and everybody, in order to make progress, needs to still dive through all of the layers of the stack. It's just much harder because their access to it has been obfuscated, which is obviously not the right thing.
Yeah, exactly.
So I work for a research firm, and often we guide people through, like, how do you do zero trust and privacy by design, those kind of concepts. The biggest challenge I always have is, how do you make security sexy and valuable and something that people want to do and want to buy into? So I always have trouble with that story, because short of hitting them around the head, like, it's really difficult to get them to do the right thing. What's your advice on that?
I think a lot of security companies sell via fear, right? Mm. It's all about, hey, you don't want to be the next Jaguar Land Rover. Which isn't a great situation. The reason I joined ChainGuard is because ChainGuard is very focused on improving supply chain security and making things better for people. Before that, I did a lot of talks on supply chain security, and I was obviously saying things like, hey, this is a problem, we should fix this. And, you know, I never tried to really fix anything myself. Maybe I would say, hey, you can go and use this tool or something. But until I joined ChainGuard, I wasn't really working on helping solve the problem. So that's one of the reasons I really like ChainGuard. But I still think fear is probably one of the main selling points. If somebody has a better selling point.
That's what I see as well.
That's what I see as well.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
So my question also goes a bit in the direction of how to give every engineer basically the tool set to ask at the right point in engineering something, hey, I have a problem, maybe I don't know everything about this certain aspect of security, then they can go to an enabling team or to somebody who knows it better, that in the end you don't have an incident or something where you have to react and fix it quickly and so on, but be a bit ahead of the wave there. Because in the end it boils down probably to training and enablement and encouraging and so on, and supporting everybody. But the field is so vast and constantly changing, and then there's not only security but tons of other stuff, shift left. So do you see a direction where this is going, or what would be something good to investigate in there?
Yeah, I think from my perspective, it's something that needs to be continuously revisited. So one of the big things is that security isn't something that just stops. I think there was a quote from one of the talks yesterday that was like, the fastest way to move backwards is to stand still, right? Like, it's particularly, I think that's true in the security space. You finally get secure and then something else comes out and you have to keep going. So I think it's about how to like scan for helping people know that they should be asking for help as well. So what can your security experts that kind of exist in your organization do to try and identify opportunities to have conversations with people and prompt them to come to them? So I think, yeah, I struggle with asking software teams to know when to raise their hand, because then you're sort of asking them to become experts. So how do you give them the prompt to raise their hands, I think?
Yeah. I think a big focus at the minute, I mean, you kind of get into like the fashions and where we're going with security. I think a major focus at the minute, it probably is like supply chain and open source. Like, we all depend on these open source projects, and we see like NPM problems the whole time, and how do we help those projects have better security? And that's a really hard one to answer, because, you know, these are volunteers, and the CVE system is very broken. Like, you, I don't know how many of you are aware of like the curl, the issues curl have with like people opening like CVEs that are just nonsense. And that, you know, takes time away from the developers answering these nonsense CVEs. And yeah, it's unfortunately quite a broken system at the minute. But yeah, I think we're going to see a lot of focus on open source over the next few years, and how we consume open source and how we make sure it's secure. And, you know, I mean, that's from the company I work for is very focused on as well. So, but I find it hard to say where it's going to go and where it's going to end. No, sorry, I shouldn't. I'm taking over.
Have you seen companies using gamification like threat modeling or green teaming on Fridays or something like that to be successful, to have a better developer experience? That's a question I always have in mind, but I don't know how to tell it to the product owner that I need another Friday afternoon to get this for security.
I think quite often people pay like to have pen tests and things like that, so that's quite common. I'm not sure how to sell to your department. Again, it probably comes down to fear, which is a little bit sad. But our CISO like showed me this quote the other day, and it was by somebody called Wazawaka, who's like a famous ransomware hacker. And he basically said, if all the ransomware hackers were to swap places with the cybersecurity experts, then all the attacks would stop. Because basically, the people like me and that talk about cybersecurity and are running the defense side, we don't know how to do the attacks, or a lot of us don't anyway, not all of us. But the people that are doing the attacks probably can't act as defenders very well. So we're in quite a bad position at the minute. And yeah, that kind of scared me when I sort of thought about that quote and what the implications of it are.
I think from using things like the red, green, and things like that, it has to do with also what the responsibilities of the team are. So I think those kinds of activities work really well when a team is responsible for the production environment, because you don't have to talk about security to do that. So I implemented a chaos engineering initiative at one of my companies where we would do that regularly. We'd set an experiment, right? So everyone's like, oh, chaos, what's that? No, it's a scientific experiment. You have you know how to get back to normal quickly if you need to, and you're doing it, you're starting learning it in lower environments before you try in production, things like that. And the reason that that was successful is because a team I was on call for our software. And so we were able to make the business case around like our speed to resolution improving when we would practice what does it look like to get woken up with an incident, manage it, and things like that. And so I think if you don't have build it, run it, it's going to be a hard sell to do things that are run it related in the build it team. And so I think that maybe is the first thing to try and knock down, is like that divide, or talk to the team that's running it and say, can we team up together in some way and make that case?
I'm just sad that you, because you could almost call your red team afternoons hackathons, except that that name is already taken.
So I'm like going to totally show my age here. But when I was a sysadmin, most of what we had to do was, you know, just only connect onto the internet for a minute to get the email go back and forth and every hour, and that was that was kind of security. But no, seriously, there was somebody in my company that loved doing it and kept up with things. And so listening to what you're saying and really just trying to onboard very fast here, but it seems like there's just, it's the problem that there's not enough security people because it, you know, you just need someone who thinks this kind of geekery and the importance of the role is important, and you want them integrated onto the teams. And if anything, you want an oversupply of these people so that they can be programming some of the time, but then if there's a security problem, they're kind of spotting. So what is it, could you say, what do you think is it's holding up that there's not an adequate supply of people that are interested in the challenge and the excitement that is security?
Well, I think it's more people don't want to pay. Like, I mean, if nothing's happening, then you don't, you know, no company's going to pay 20 security to people unless they can see something coming out.
And it's not good enough to have sort of a program that's a bit extra and sort of into it as a hobby.
Well, I think that gets back to your point in training. I think that probably does work.
I don't know, though. I think, so one challenge with that is it a false sense of security to have everybody sort of aware of cross-site scripting, but not like aware of the deeper, more malicious activity. So I get slightly worried about the idea of like, oh, we'll just do this as our side gig, because there's it's not a bad thing to get people aware and interested in the industry or like the side of the industry. But as soon as you start to go, well, you've, you know, read some blog posts about security in the like OWASP top 10, so you're now our security person. It's like, I think there is a false sense of security, which is ironic, there, that I worry about a lot.
I think there's a question of incentives as well, because when you were talking about, you know, the sort of the team that has 20 security people in it, I sort of shudder because it sounds like my nightmare team to work in, because it's this exact same thing as we used to have with dev and ops, right, where dev are incentivized to deliver and ops are incentivized on stability, which as a dev, my perception is that you're incentivized to stop me delivering. And so you just, and it's the same with security, right? They're incentivized to prevent incidents. The best way to prevent incidents is if nobody does any work from, you know, my developer perspective. And so you sort of, you have to fix that problem and get teams pulling in the same direction and get the, we were talking about this a bit earlier as well, like if you can get things becoming more secure in a way that also makes them better for developers, then that's the win that you want for. So for example, with pipelines, we have it now where the best way to keep your software secure is to do continuous delivery and to be pulling in the updates, and stale security or stale software is, the developers hate it and the security team hates it. So everybody wins because they're pulling in the same direction.
I think what we had one example of where developer experience was actually improved by security, which was password managers, yeah. Right? So there's lots of things where security doesn't hurt developer experience, but there's very few that we could think of. So I'd be interested if anyone else has any ideas there where actually security is coming along and enhancing like your life, yeah. which is part of that whole, you know, why aren't people attracted to this? You know, how do we get investment into security? It's sort of the fear-based is the most common, and that's unfortunate. So
yeah, because most of the time, improving security involves adding a hurdle, which is annoying. Even if it's just like pushing a button in the security key, you know, it's still a hurdle.
It's annoying, yeah.
I think it's a really good question why we don't have a bigger supply of security people, because it's a really fascinating and hot topic, basically, research topic still. One thing I have observed where I've worked is that it can be really hard to reach out and take that security role without also getting the compliance role.
Ooh. Yeah.
And in my experience, it tends to be very different people who are, I mean, both roles are super important, but it tends to be very different people that are attracted to doing one and doing the other. And it can be hard to be, or you run the risk if you raise your hand trying to become the security expert, of also getting all the compliance burden, at least within security. I guess the question to the room is that just where I've been working, or is that a general trend?
I think that's fair. My life was better when I hadn't heard about FIPS. Yeah, and for the people that didn't laugh, that means you don't know about FIPS and you are better off.
I think I see that a lot as well. They sort of bundle it. And you can even see it just in marketing of software products. It's like, it's always like compliance and security are right next to each other as words, right? And I think that is a very common thing. But I think it is really interesting that you call that out, because it is different personality types. It is different interests that do those two things. So
yeah, especially if you think about the sort of the, maybe we need to be making more space and more roles for that kind of, you know, anarchic white hat hacker, you know, because they're having fun and they can be quite fun to be around, but that you do not want them doing the compliance, and they don't want to be doing the compliance.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Thanks. I'm kind of bringing it back to this platform engineering as very enticing to me. Often in my career, I've had continuously this, you know, a disagreement, perhaps, or healthy debate, maybe we can think about, between, you know, what does it mean, sensible defaults that are provided by a vendor or a provider, versus maybe what we think is a sensible default as the platform team, or maybe even for a particular use case or something. I'm curious, reflections from you all, kind of the tensions and the trade-offs you've seen in those conversations, and what makes sense to have in those conversations. Because obviously arguing, yeah, you need to pay us 6 months to build a better platform when we're already using AWS defaults for X, Y, and Z, this is a hard sell. So I'm really curious, like, your reflections on this.
Yeah, I think my definition of when you should build an internal platform, so something that's custom to your organization, is when you need something custom to your organization, but it also is common to enough teams to be a value add there. And so I think that is an interesting space, because there are organizations that are doing enough unique things that actually they don't get to that economy of scale for their internal platform. If they were to try and standardize, they actually have to create so many individual use cases that they aren't at economy of scale, and then the DevOps model actually works best, because then each team can do what they need to, when they need to, and do it well. And there's also a lot of organizations out there that are pre-product market fit, or they are, you know, very non-differentiated in the way that they deliver software, and they can just go and pay a compliant platform as a service, whether that be a cloud provider or a SaaS product or something else, to just go and deliver their software. And they should. So when should you invest? When should you ask, you know, can I have time and money to build something custom? It's when you have something that is unique to your business, that is actually a differentiator for your business, but is common to the teams around you. And often, I say differentiator for your business, but often it's really just the cruft over the years. So it's older organizations that have built up the way they do compliance in a way that they just don't know how to undo. And so it is custom to their business. It may not be a differentiator, but it's the way that they get approvals for all the compliance that they have and all those things. So when I talk about platforms, that's what I'm talking about. You're asking about, or you're mentioning how to get the buy-in for that, or how to set the default. So the way that I build Cradix as an open source framework for building platforms, and the way that we advocate and work with customers on it is start with the most baseline API for your internal platform that you can. So what I mean by that is, if you're happy to take all the defaults from your cloud provider and pass them straight to your engineers, and it doesn't break any rules in your organization, start with an API, internal API, that does that. Usually, that's not the case if you're investing in a platform. Usually there's something else that you want to add in as your sensible default. But so whatever that baseline is, and then build in the use cases. So the most common one I see is around sort of buckets. There's buckets that are meant for static websites. There's buckets that are meant for internal documents. There's buckets that are meant for external access. Those are three different use cases. Those all boil down to some baseline requirements that all buckets have to have. Versioning, you know, encryption, things like that. And then down to the cloud provider. So, I guess it's talking about composability of your internal platform. So I guess what I'd call out is you want to take ownership over, and if you're investing in an internal platform, you want to take ownership over it and set your own defaults on top, but then be composable up to more opinionated versions of that. But knowing that someone who starts with your opinionated version very well might come up with a change in their requirements that would require them to have more access to things. So be composable, give them access to lower level as and when they need it. So I don't know if that answers, and if anyone wants to add anything.
I don't have too much exposure to that side. Where I would come in that kind of area is that we do talk to a lot of platform engineering teams because they will buy like secure base images from us. And quite often that will help do that much better than they will. And sometimes they call it a golden image program. I don't really like that term because that's really like an old VM term. But and there it kind of makes sense because, you know, we can sell them like these images that will save them a whole bunch of time instead of them trying to remediate and create their own base images.
And some people will be able to take it off the shelf and hand it straight out. But what a lot of organizations that are a bit more complex will do, or like, and scaled will do, is they'll know maybe we don't want to give straight access from software devs to ChainGuard, because if we ever want to change vendors, if we ever want to add something else that's common to our teams, but ChainGuard isn't part of ChainGuard's roadmap, we want to have a control point there. And so they'll sort of build that intermediary layer, and then they have access to be able to inject, you know, that additional like local libraries that you're never going to put into the ChainGuard common, you know, images, because it's that specific to this organization. That's their logging library. So, but they want it on all their images. So here's how they kind of put their fingers in. Yeah. So I think that's where the platform can come in and be powerful.
I think there's a lot of good software engineers here that probably can do really good security within the software, but the software also needs to run on something, you know, infrastructure. And I actually see, from my perspective, that is sometimes what people are struggling with, that the infrastructure itself also needs, you know, different configurations to be secure, right? It's fine that you build a really good API that is the most secure in the world, right? But if you have a S3 bucket that is totally open to the world with all your contacts, you know, that, you know, then your API doesn't matter, right? How, you know, I don't know if I don't have a question. It's more like a reflection, you know, that it's so important also with the infrastructure, right? And that's also what I see sometimes people struggling with. Now I'm in a team where we provide, where we manage the cloud providers, and we have tried to set up guardrails around the infrastructure to make sure that your S3 bucket is not open for public access, right?
And so I guess I'd have a question to you, if that's the team that you're on, is how do you keep that up to date? So like, so with those guardrails, is it that you're handing over sort of infrastructure as code templates or guidelines to people, and then that they're sort of owning the infrastructure, you're just the advisor? Or is it something that you're also keeping up to date for them?
I think first we had these service security requirements we actually published, so everybody could see that how you were supposed to configure your S3 bucket, right? But people forgot to look at that, right? Then we tried enforcement, and that can also be a little hard, right? So when people try to run the CI/CD pipeline, it fails deploying, and nothing to do. You know, we don't shift left at all because it will fail in the infrastructure itself. So I'm not sure we have found the golden coin.
So there's always another phrase, right, to share. So there's a gentleman from Google, Richard Sirotor, who, it's like 3 years old now, I think, this article about shift down.
Oh, and so good, that article.
It's a very good article. So you should check it out. It's and I think that encapsulates the idea that I would maybe like suggest looking into, which is, what is your contract with these software teams? Within my kind of company and my friends and all that, we call it the puppy for Christmas thing. When you give someone, you know, the rules or the infrastructure as code or whatever, you're like, look, I've written this Terraform module here. And it's like, yay. Oh, I have to take it out for a walk again and again, three, four times a day. And oh, I have to bring it to the vet and I have to go get it clipped and all these things. And so I think, what do these application teams actually care about? They care about a URI that they can send data to. They care about the understanding the reliability of their service. And so there needs to be some guarantees on this service. But they actually don't care if it's S3 or Google Storage. They don't care if it's encrypted or not, particularly, let's be honest. They care that they are meeting expectations. They care that it can't get hacked. But like, they're not the ones who are sitting there going, well, let me make sure I tick that box. Like, they're like, I just want it to work. I want it to be secure. I want it to work. So I think where we're being challenged right now as an industry is where we set those contracts. And I have a theory / a hope that we start to allow upgrades and updates and security measures and things like policies like this to be owned by the people who care about them, which is going to require us to be more clear on the contracts we have between the people who use them and the people who care about the like configuration of them. Because I can't go and update your database for you if I don't know that your application is going to continue to work when I bump minor versions. So if there's not a clear contract there with clear testing and clear contract testing available, then that's going to be a challenge. And that's why we have this muddled ownership model. But we don't have a muddled ownership model with the clouds. Like AWS is particularly famous for having the shared responsibility model. Anyone who's done any compliance on the cloud will know it well. You can say, I use AWS, so physical security is covered, kind of thing, yes. And so, but they're like, look, once you've spun up that VM, like, it's up to you to keep the OS up to date because I can't go muddling about with it. Like, I can tell you that the networking is secure. I can tell you that the data center is secure, but the rest of it is up to you. We need that same shared responsibility model with the teams that depend on our internal infrastructure, and instead we have a very muddled ownership model that I think causes a lot of problems.
Can I ask the audience a question? Has any of your companies like banned AI, so you're not allowed to use like OpenAI or ChatGPT? Has anybody tried banning it? One, a couple. Because this is something I'm actually I'm actually very worried about companies banning it. Because what's going to happen is they're going to go back to this like skunkworks place where your employees are using AI. It's just you've banned it, so you have no control over it, and that's actually really bad with AI because your employees are going to be sending like, you know, your data to ChatGPT or whatever, and they will be training on it. If you instead buy licenses or do a deal with ChatGPT or OpenAI and Anthropic and all those, you can make it so that they won't train on that data. But at the minute, they're going to be training on your sensitive data quite potentially. So definitely be aware of that. Yeah. Yeah. You don't want them using personal accounts, and so you're going to have to give them a business account because that's what they're going to use otherwise.
So what happened to us was we got a policy that we could only use the company internal 3.5 ChatGPT.
Yeah.
And that ran for 6 months, and then they forgot about it. And so the policy is still there, but we're being pushed to use AI, but there's no AI we're allowed to use.
Yeah.
So it's not really banned, it's just kinda, and then they forgot.
Well, yeah, but you're in this impossible situation. Yeah, it's ridiculous.
There was a talk about by Liberty earlier today, and we have a similar model with like several models available internally. You get a redirect with a public one. But I hope I get to ask one more question. Yeah. SSL inspection, what's your take?
I'm sorry?
Running all your traffic through a box that decrypts it, looks into it, and like an endpoint, then encrypts it again? Shouldn't we do that?
Well, Cloudflare does that, don't they? You can like set it up so there's a TLS endpoint on Cloudflare for your static sites.
You buy centralized man in the middle attack.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah, they didn't market it that way, though. I think they might have been less successful. So I think that's probably, we are at time, and I think there is keynote.
Keynote first.
Sorry, that was...
Something's on the brain.
Yeah,
calm yourself,
very disappointed people. Yes, we have keynote. But yeah, thank you very much, everybody, for the questions. And I think, Adrian and Abby around for a little while longer if people have more questions.
Oh, we're speaking tomorrow,
Yes, opportunity to ask more questions. So yeah, thanks again, everybody.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.